This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. We've spent hours dissecting the anatomy of the internet, chronicling concerns about privacy, the appeal of connection, our willful, woeful walled gardens, and the fumbled attempts to regulate any of it at all. But we hadn't been clued into the systemic nature of the increasing crappiness of being on, let's call it, big digital, until now.
Federal regulators claim that Facebook misled parents and failed to protect the privacy of children using its Messenger Kids app. Federal Trade Commission says Facebook misrepresented the access it provided to private...
Two San Diego women are suing Amazon in a proposed class action lawsuit against...
Claiming Amazon Prime members who pay $139 a year for membership have been misled for years regarding shipping times.
Recently, CEO Elon Musk said people must pay $8 a month for the Twitter Blue subscription service. Journalists, politicians, city and government organizations who would not pay have been stripped of their verified status, causing chaos and confusion about what information can be trusted.
The tech industry, changing the world as it does in mysterious ways, is bound to spark editorial tongue-clucking and laments about how it's just not the way it used to be. But this is different. Those cluckers are right. And Cory Doctorow, journalist, activist, and the author of many books, most recently Red Team Blues, a science fiction crime thriller, has tracked this phenomenon for a long while and knows why. He'll be our guide over the next 3 weeks, exploring and explaining the process whereby going online grows ever less rewarding and ever more repellent. But to start things off, this trend should have a name. Luckily, Doctorow has one. He calls it enfication. Yeah, it's absolutely accurate and totally not allowed on broadcast radio.
Enfication is the death cycle of platforms, and platforms are the native form of the internet. Because, on the one hand, the internet doesn't have a lot of competition, and also because digital is so flexible, it means you have these companies that are really neither disciplined by regulation nor by competition, and who can kind of change the rules as they go.
Now get into the nitty-gritty of the process, which you managed to compress into three distinct steps.
Step one, first, the company is good to its users. So think about Amazon. When Amazon started, it had a lot of shareholder capital and was able to operate at a loss. Sold you goods for less than they cost. It subsidized the price of shipping. It subsidized the price of returns. You know, Jeff Bezos was like a good-natured slob who just wanted you to have stuff below cost.
Just so you know, here's what's hot. Digital camera, razor, scooter, leather, and tools. We've even got the George Foreman grill for you.
But if you need an item that is not hot,
click on blood pressure monitors and tissue box cozies, velour dinkies and scaffolding.
And lots of people piled in. You know, this was especially true of Amazon's digital goods, right? Kindle and then later Audible. Again, they sold these things below cost. And, you know, there were lots of things that Amazon fixed that were really broken for a lot of people. People who have disabilities and couldn't leave the house, people who needed to get large things. There was a point early on where Amazon started off with putting all kinds of things in Prime for free shipping. And there was this point where people on the internet were trying to find the heaviest item that you could get free shipping on. And you could buy like a 2-ton safe. And good-natured old Uncle Jeff would pick up the shipping tab to deliver 2 tons of tempered steel to your front porch. Those were the good old days.
So you say, lots of us piled in, lots of brick-and-mortar retailers withered and died, making it harder to go elsewhere.
Step one is figuring out how not just to give the users a good deal, but to then spring the trap, right? So that they don't go. break your local retail so that the only place to shop is Amazon, prepay for Prime, getting you to prepay for a year's worth of shipping, right? Who's going to shop anywhere else if you've already paid for the shipping? It's also getting you to prepay for a book every month. So the Audible subscription packages are extraordinarily generous because that means that you would never buy an audiobook anywhere else because you've already bought the book. And then with the digital stuff, they also use digital rights management, which is this kind of encryption that locks the file to their authorized player. So you can only read a Kindle book in a player that Amazon has authorized. You can only listen to an Audible book in a player that Amazon has authorized. And the thing about digital rights management is that since 1998, when Bill Clinton signed the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, it has been a felony to give someone a tool to remove digital rights management, even if no copyright infringement ever takes place. So if you buy one of my books on Amazon, which you can't because none of my books are sold on Amazon with digital rights management, but if they were, and I supplied you with the tool that lets you take the DRM off, the digital rights management off, and go to a rival platform so you could break up with Amazon, I would commit a felony punishable by a 5-year prison sentence and a $500,000 fine. Those are penalties that are much stiffer than if you just stole the book.
Wow. So then go to step 2, when the platform starts to squeeze users for the betterment of their business partners.
So the platform is now a thing that you're locked to, partly because you like it, and partly because it's got all of your recurring subscriptions, playlists, all your music or movies or books or everything are kind of stuck in its walled garden. Now they can start doing things like allocating other surpluses, as our friend in the economics trade would say, to these sellers.
What does that mean, allocating surpluses?
Surpluses are just goodies, right? It's what's left over after you're running the business or what you have in your bank account that you can spread around. Amazon can run the business at a loss, but it can get money from selling shares or by borrowing money. Other surpluses might be your privacy to pitch ads to you. So Amazon takes some surplus and it starts to allocate it to those business users.
Charges them low fees for preferential treatment.
Really low platform fees, preferential treatment, ads. If you're a Kindle author or an Audible author, the royalties are crazily good. And this is at a time when publishing is really in the toilet. Some of that is down to Amazon. So Amazon is being good to its suppliers, but not all of them. Amazon ran a project called Project Gazelle. And in this project, they went to their small and medium publishers and they demanded discounts from them that were so deep that the publishers actually were losing money on their sales. And the reason it was called Project Gazelle is that the managers in charge of this were exhorted to think of themselves as cheetahs bringing down the sickly gazelles in the herd. Mm. The only thing that Amazon's lawyers objected to about this was the name of the program. And so they're making stuff cheaper and they're offering authors really good deals because Project Gazelle is making all the publishers disappear. And so you have other kinds of suppliers, creative workers piling into the platform. You have readers, you have writers, you have buyers, you have sellers. And even if things are getting a little worse for the buyers, it's still a pretty good deal.
We're still at step 2. Consumers won't find better prices elsewhere. Sellers won't find a bigger pile of consumers. We arrive at step 3, and this is where the ominous organ chord sounds. Because after squeezing the consumer for the business folks, the platform then squeezes the business folks to further enrich Amazon.
Amazon's turning to the merchants and saying, hey, if you want to come to the top of the search results, even if you're not selling the thing that our customer is searching for, you can buy ads. Amazon has this $31 billion ad market now. I mean, they have a little bit of the kind of ads we think of when we say ads, which is like you're a publisher and you want to run ads alongside your content. But most of their ad market is just payola. It's just saying, if you want to be the top result for Duracell, you've got to outbid everybody else who wants to be the top result for Duracell.
Even Duracell?
The last time I searched for Duracell on Amazon, there was a banner across the top that said Duracell. And then in the corner, it said sponsored post. Duracell outbid everyone who wasn't Duracell to have a banner across the top of the screen that said Duracell when you go searching specifically for Duracell.
And you mentioned the $31 billion ad market that Amazon is so proud of.
Right. And it's important to note here that this is a withdrawal of surplus from both end users and business customers. Because when you type a search into Amazon, right, if you're looking for a gasket for the water filter in your fridge and you type in your fridge manufacturer, water filter and gasket.
That's awfully random, Corey, but please go on.
We just bought one. And it's exactly the kind of thing that it used to be like, oh, God, do I have to figure out where to get this rubber ring that is precisely this size? Mm-hmm. And so you type that in, and if Amazon is being kind to you, the top result is that thing. It's an incredible service, yeah. Actually. Mm-hmm. But when Amazon opens the floodgates to say you can bid against it, then you get all kinds of stuff, including things that don't fit your fridge. It's just because Amazon has like done the math and said, overall, allowing people to advertise anything to any search term gets us more business than the ill will generated by people at the periphery who do irrational things like advertise the wrong size gasket against your fridge manufacturer.
Amazon knows that you're going to be really annoyed and may end up going to the local hardware store or Target, but it's making the guess that you're just going to stay.
That you won't go elsewhere because there's no other retail, because you've already prepaid for shipping, because. Then they don't have to take as much care of you, right? They don't have to be quite so relentless. You remember Lily Tomlin in the old sketch, right?
So the next time you complain about your phone service, why don't you try using two Dixie cups with a string? We don't care. We don't have to. We're the phone company.
Companies that don't fear losing your business know that they can treat you worse.
So sum this up, the first three steps.
So step one. Buyers or end users are lured in with a good offer, but they're also locked in with subtle things that keep them from leaving if the offer gets worse. And then things are made worse for the buyers to make things better for the sellers and bring in lots of sellers, but they too are locked in. And once you have buyers and sellers who are locked in and can't leave, all of the good stuff is taken away from both of them. Life is made worse for them, and life is made infinitely better for the shareholders who own the platform, in this case, Jeff Bezos and his pals.
Can you walk us through
Sure. The
three steps of Facebook's in-shitification?
So Facebook is a kind of canonical case of in-shitification. So when Facebook started, everyone already had a social media account with MySpace. And so Facebook's pitch to MySpace users was, come to Facebook and tell us who matters to you. Tell us who your friends are. If they're on the platform, anytime they say something that they want their friends to know about, we'll show it to you. Just reverse chronological order feed of everything that the people you care about have to say. And so that's the first stage. We're not spying on you. We're showing you the things that the people you like are saying. Stage two is they want to bring in two kinds of business customers, advertisers, and we'll call them publishers, but it's publishers, it's performers, it's brands, it's TV networks, it's anyone who wants to reach an audience, but isn't like just an advertiser. And so to the advertisers, they say, remember when we told our users that we were never going to spy on them? We've changed our mind. We've actually got a ton of surveillance data on them, and we will let you use it really cheaply. To the media companies, they said, hey, you know what you need? You need a funnel to drive traffic to your own website. So all you need to do is post like an excerpt from your article along with a link. And then to the users, they said, do you remember when we promised you that we were only going to show you the things that the people you cared about had to say? Well, we're altering the deal a little here. We're also going to like non-consensually ram down your eyeballs, brief excerpts from media articles and advertisements. So step one, we're going to show you what the people that you like have to say, and we're not going to spy on you. Step two, we're going to be good to our business customers. We're going to spy on you, target ads to you, show you the stuff that you never asked to see, which is content for media brands mm-hmm. and performers mm-hmm. and publishers.
Facebook was a really helpful platform for media companies, right? I mean, we still post our segments and shows on Facebook, but then...
Then they take the goodies away from the publishers. Facebook subtly turns the screws to make this happen. They start to say, actually, we're going to show your stuff less frequently unless you are more generous in what you put on the platform. And so what you have as a business customer, an advertiser, is a declining business proposition. If you're a media brand, Facebook is not a funnel for traffic to your own site. You structure your material so that it lives on Facebook and never leaves anywhere else. And even then, Facebook still wants you to pay to boost your content, mm-hmm. which is their cutesy word again for payola, mm-hmm. to reach your own subscribers. Mm. And for advertisers, well, Facebook starts to do a lot of ad fraud.
What do you mean ad fraud?
So for example, Facebook and Google engaged in a secret, unlawful, collusive arrangement called Jedi Blue that was identified in the Texas Attorney General's antitrust mm-hmm. case, where they just agreed that they were going to like charge advertisers more, pay publishers less, and pocket the difference. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, there's a lot of complexity to how they managed it. But at the end of the day, all of these accounting scams just boil down to, we stole some money from
you.
And that's what they did. Mm-hmm. They stole money from advertisers.
So now take us to step three.
So step three, advertising is getting worse. You're paying more. You're reaching your targeted audience less well. And for users, your feed now only incidentally consists of things that people that you love and care about have said. It's a bad deal all around.
What about Meta?
Some people say the metaverse will only be virtual. But one day, this lecture hall will be made of code. And though they're virtual students, what they'll learn together is real.
Yeah, I mean, as a cyberpunk writer, I just find it deeply depressing and offensive that they think that it was a suggestion and not a warning. It's really scary. So here's Facebook, right? They have made this bad deal for users. They've made this bad deal for advertisers. They've made this bad deal for publishers. But they tried to leave enough goodies in the system that users don't leave, advertisers don't leave, and publishers don't leave. They all feel like they can't, even if every time they log in, every time they write a check, they're just like, ugh, this is terrible. And the thing about that equilibrium, right, that state where you've got just enough surplus in to keep people using it, but not so much that there's any extra, it's brittle. It just takes one good competitor like TikTok, or one big scandal like a live stream mass shooting, or one big privacy debacle like Cambridge Analytica, and it can tip. And, you know, we're talking about Facebook, but I think the example that everyone can relate to here is Twitter, mm-hmm. right? Twitter has gone from indispensable to completely dispensable for larger and larger groups of people, businesses, movements, and so on very quickly, even though it felt like there was nowhere else that you could conceivably go. And so when that happens, when the platform tips over and becomes a useless pile of shit, which is the end of shitification, then it starts to thrash. And so in that world, Mark Zuckerberg has to pivot, which is Silicon Valley for thrash. Pivoting in his case is, let's all be legsless, sexless, highly surveilled, low polygon cartoon characters in a virtual world named after a satire from a dystopian cyberpunk novel. And, you know, long before we had the folly of Elon Musk, we had the folly of Mark Zuckerberg, who was able to do these really reckless things. And maybe he wouldn't have been able to do it if his board had been there going like, wait, what are you doing? No, you're eating the seed corn. Stop it.
I'm wondering, you talk about the collective action problem. You know, there are consumers who argue that their platforms are still working for them. But is it perhaps not that their Amazon searches are that helpful or their Facebook feed is that fun, but that they can't imagine a world without them?
People aren't lying when they say they get value out of these services. That's the point, right? If the service is playing in shitification right and not tipping over, then they are leaving a reason to stay behind. Mm-hmm. So if you've got a rare disease and everyone else who shares that rare disease has found each other on Facebook, then Facebook isn't just valuable, it might be invaluable to you. And so there is lots of value in these services. That's why we use them. But the thing that the platforms want us to think is that there is no way to arrange their products and services such that all the things that we hate about them wouldn't come with the things that we love about them. That they are inseparable. That surveillance is a part of search and could not ever be anything but a part of search. Right? That a bearded prophet came down off a mount with two stone tablets and said, Larry, Sergey, thou shalt stop rotating thine log files and lo, thou shalt mine them for actionable market intelligence. But, you know, Google didn't surveil Facebook. We know that you can make a Facebook without spying on people. How do we know that? Because Facebook used to be the social media service that didn't spy on you. What these platforms would like you to believe is what Margaret Thatcher wanted us to believe.
There is no alternative.
There is no alternative. To paraphrase whoever said it, maybe it was Zizek, maybe it was Jameson, it is harder to imagine the end of the world itself than it is to imagine the end of Amazon.
Cory Doctorow is the author of the new novel Red Team Blues and special advisor to the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Cory, are you up for talking about how we enabled this situation, and will you give us a definitive definition of twiddling?
I will, and I will, and I am.
Next week, the great Cory Doctorow returns for part two of our three-part conversation about the embleepification of big internet. And that's the show. On the Media is produced by Micah Lowinger, Eloise Blondio, Molly Schwartz, Rebecca Clark-Callender, Candice Wong, and Suzanne Gaber. With help from Tammy George, our technical directors Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Andrew Nuriano and Sham Sundra. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.